they're all we have. They're all we have. I smile when I see them. I'm happy to see them. They're all we have right now.
And in the White House, you have Stephen Bannon. There's questions whether he'll remain, but of course, there have been those questions for many months right now. You have Sebastian Gorka. You have Stephen Miller. These are well-known people who represent this white nationalist strain, this thread, where you have Stephen Miller, one of the advisors to President Trump, actually holding the White House news briefing last week and saying perhaps the poem by Emma Lazarus, Give Me Your Tired, Your Poor, should be removed from the Statue of Liberty, that it shouldn't have gone up there to begin with. It wasn't a part of it originally.
Right, right. I mean, these folks represent the worst in us. You know, you represent the worst in America. And again, I cannot emphasize that the path was laid by mainstream acceptable politicians who heard, you know, this birth of business, who saw all this, who heard, you know, people, you know, consistently lobbying racist attacks at the president and did nothing and just stood aside. And so, you know, the idea that the party would then be taken over by a much more extreme, a much more vocal sort of white supremacy is not shocking. If you did nothing, you know, if you didn't speak up, you know, during the Obama era, when these, you know, claims of racism, when these charges of racism were being lobbed, if you just stood aside, you're part of the problem. You're part of how we got here. You know, and you don't get off by, you know, after somebody's been killed in Charlottesville, you know, making a statement, you know, about white supremacy at this late hour. After the fruit is already
come. We have to leave it there. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. His forthcoming book, We Were 8 Years in Power. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your Tuesday evening news. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver. His stage show, An Evening with Dan Levinson, is an intimate evening of musical conversation that combines old-time fiddle, Appalachian banjo, stories and song in a storytelling format to tell the story of life in rural Appalachia and life on the road. Again, that's An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a woman infiltrated Trump Tower this afternoon and dropped a banner reading Women Resist White Supremacy prior to President Trump's scheduled media conference.
More alt-right rallies, like the recent one in Charlottesville, are scheduled to take place in at least 9 U.S. cities this weekend.
And yesterday morning in Denver, advocates held a public press conference to update us on a class action lawsuit against the city for violating the rights of houseless people.
This is good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 15th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Kyle Carrezzi. With the expected arrival of 1 million people coming to Oregon this month to view the total eclipse on the 21st, officials are warning on the high risk of wildfires. Oregon is at the height of the fire season at this time, and crews have already been battling wildfires throughout the state. A burn ban is in effect in Benton County. No recreational fires or campfires will be allowed, and the Benton County Sheriff's Office will be patrolling forested areas to ensure campers adhere to this ban. The Corvallis Fire Department is also expected to be on high alert for this event. The Forest Service is expected to have 6 engines on hand, as well as a helicopter on standby at the Corvallis Airport. Forest Service staff will also be stationed at various points around the state to direct people and answer questions.
A female activist got inside Trump Tower this afternoon and dropped a banner reading, "Women Resist White Supremacy," circumventing elaborate security measures installed for the president's visit. Ultraviolet, a women's advocacy group known for using social media, phone lobby, and newspaper campaigns to advance awareness of women's issues, has claimed credit for the banner in tandem with the Working Families Party, a progressive group focused on economic issues. The Working Families Party has chapters in at least 7 states, including New York and Oregon. Ultraviolet co-founder Nita Chowdhury issued a statement condemning the recent white supremacist demonstration in Charlottesville, saying, quote, "If Donald Trump won't stand up against these hate mongers, including those within his own administration, women will," end quote. Trump Tower is currently barricaded by metal police barriers and dump trucks filled with sand, among other heightened security measures designed to keep the president and his entourage safe. The banner-dropping stunt took place before the president held a media conference at Trump Tower today. The woman who dropped the banner was led away by police and reportedly arrested. And now it's time for today's report from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A court case in Alaska claims the way state juries are selected discriminates against rural Native communities. KYUK's Teresa Kotsarilis reports.
According to the ACLU's Tara Rich, Alaska's state court systems don't select jurors from dozens of the state's remote villages, citing cost. These excluded villages are largely Alaska Native, and as a result, Rich says that 30% of Alaska Natives will never be called to serve on a jury, even though Alaska Natives are disproportionately represented in the state's criminal justice system. When residents are accused of a crime, the jury that judges them might not have Native members at all.
And that is such a critical part about the fairness of this process.
Rich says that the ACLU got involved after Teddy Smith, an Inupiat man from a remote village, was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 99 years in prison. None of the jurors who judged him were from remote villages themselves. Smith is appealing his case, and the ACLU and the Native American Rights Fund have jointly filed a Friend of the Court brief, arguing that Alaska's jury selection system violates Smith and other defendants' civil rights. The appeal and Friend of the Court brief are currently pending before the Alaska Court of Appeals. For KYUK, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
The small town of White Clay, Nebraska, has been getting a facelift since its 4 liquor stores closed in May. They once sold millions of cans of beer a year to residents of the nearby Pine Ridge Reservation. As Jim Kent reports, roads have been cleaned up, old buildings torn down, and business development is underway.
That's the sound of heavy equipment in White Clay, Nebraska, preparing for the arrival of a family dollar store. Take a tour around town and you'll find open fields of sunflowers where dilapidated buildings once stood, streets free of trash, and empty back roads where intoxicated people once gathered. Bruce Bonfloor is the pastor at Lakota Hope Ministry in White Clay.
This is part of the new White Clay. It's clean, it's safe, it's quiet. And it's progressing. It's changing. It's changing literally before people's eyes.
Not only are the streets here clean, but the street people are gone. Nadine Morrison is from Pine Ridge, but works in White Clay.
We no longer have our people sitting here in White Clay. A lot of them are home, not sure what to do with themselves. They're cleaning the yards. Some of them are still drinking, but they don't have that access to them every single day.
As for those who bought beer here, they're either going to their local bootlegger or driving to places like Chadron or Gordon, Nebraska. And though some here feel the image of a new White Clay is a bit overblown, progress may be in the eye of the beholder. Catherine Bluebird is a young Lakota artist from Wounded Knee.
Usually I won't be able to come up here and sell my work while there's people out there just asking for change. But now that I come over here, it's a safer place for me, and I can get sales to my crafts and arts now.
Just how long this progress in White Clay will continue could be determined soon. That's because the store owners go to court later this month to try to get back their liquor licenses. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The remains of two students from Carlisle Indian School have been returned to the Northern Arapaho Tribe, the Associated Press reports. Three boys who attended and died at the government-run school in Pennsylvania more than a century ago were to be exhumed, but a mismarked grave prevented the third boy from being returned to the tribe. A delegation from the Wyoming tribe traveled to Carlisle recently to receive the remains. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Yesterday in Denver, advocates and lawyers for the city's houseless residents held a press conference outside their city hall to draw attention to a class action lawsuit currently unfolding. The lawsuit, first filed a year ago on August 25, 2016, alleges violations of civil rights by the city of Denver against houseless people during sweeps of tent camps. Signs at the press conference yesterday read, "Sweep streets, not people, and everyone deserves a right to rest." Pro bono attorneys for the homeless yesterday morning filed a motion for summary judgment, which asks the District Court of Colorado to find in favor of the plaintiffs without going to trial. Yesterday evening, attorneys for the defendant, the City of Denver, filed an opposing motion for summary judgment of their own. Denver City Council approved an urban camping ban ordinance in May of 2012. Last year, the advocacy group Denver Homeless Out Loud released an analysis of the results of the ban, driven by a survey of 512 local homeless residents. The report sought to find out if it was true, as claimed by supporters of the ban, that it would be enforced with a light touch and used primarily to move houseless people from harsh outdoor conditions into social services where they would be more comfortable. The results of the report and survey show that hostile interactions with police are a regular occurrence for unhoused folks, and that, quote, "very rarely are people connecting camping ban violators to social services as directed by the ordinance."
In the aftermath of last weekend's tragedy in Charlottesville, in which three people lost their lives and 19 more were injured, more far-right rallies are scheduled for this weekend in nine cities across the country. Prominent among them is Boston, where many of the expected speakers were also in attendance in Charlottesville. On Monday, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh spoke in a joint press conference with Governor Charlie Baker, denouncing the far-right message and discouraging them from marching in Boston. Other rallies are scheduled to be held in Mountain View, California, New York, D.C., Boston, Austin, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, and Seattle. Another rally is planned for August 26th on federal land near San Francisco. Mayor Ed Lee has denounced the rally, stating that any message of hate will not be welcome. Counter protests are being planned in response to these rallies, featuring Black Lives Matter and other activist groups. There have been several responses to the events of last weekend. Among these was a march on Monday in Minneapolis by anti-racist and anti-fascist groups to honor Heather Heyer, who was murdered in Charlottesville by a white supremacist who drove a car through a crowd of counter-protesters. An effigy of the driver, James Field, was burned in front of the county jail. And in Durham County, North Carolina, demonstrators pulled down a Confederate monument in front of the courthouse. As one person climbed a ladder and tied a rope around the statue, the rest of the group chanted, "We are the revolution." The statue depicted a soldier with a gun atop a pillar with the engraving, "In memory of our boys in gray." Durham County Sheriff Mike Andrews has said he will seek to press charges, although none have been announced as of this afternoon.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Missouri AFL-CIO President Mike Lewis says enough petition signatures have been collected to give Missouri voters a people's veto on the so-called right-to-work anti-worker law. Lewis says over 112,000, more than enough signatures, are already collected to give all Missouri voters a chance to override their government on this issue.
We have exceeded that number quite handily. I feel pretty good that the people understand what would happen, and I think I feel pretty good that they're not going to allow it to happen.
The signatures will stop the so-called right-to-work law from going into effect August 28th. Instead, the people of Missouri will decide at the ballot box next year which side they are on when it comes to workers' rights. The law attacks unions financially by banning contracts between workers and employers that deduct union dues from paychecks.
People understand that this is nothing more than government overreach between private sector employers and their employees.
Trump's initially muted response to the domestic terrorism of white supremacists in Charlottesville shouldn't be surprising, given his racist enabling of neo-Nazis and neo-KKK factions from day one of his campaign. It started with the racist attack against Mexican immigrants and his pledge to build a wall. Media Matters' Chris Harrington.
The people who formed so much of his vocal online support, so much of his base in what developed into the alt-right, in these neo-Nazi fringes, in these white supremacist fringes, they jumped on the Trump bandwagon on day one.
Neo-Nazis like Richard Spencer, who held a gathering in Washington, D.C. after Trump won the election to proclaim Heil Trump, has said, "Trump thinks like me. Do you think it's a coincidence that everybody like me loves Trump and supports him?" Harrington says the media has a heavy responsibility in their ongoing coverage of the white supremacist neo-Nazi movement and Trump's enabling of that movement.
What we need is for media outlets to remember the outrage, remember the shock, remember the horror that we face with Heather Heyer's murder, and redeploy that in every instance when this bubbles back up, because it will probably not be the last time that we have to have this conversation. And that in itself is just stunning.
Workers Independent News is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
You don't clean this mess up, we will be back.
We'll be back.
We will be back. We are the one that make the profit for Nissan. We are the one. UAW, strong, baby. UAW, strong.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com and like us on Facebook. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now we hear from our friend Rick Smith. It's Labor History in Two.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day that Jerry Horgan was killed while walking the picket line. Jerry was a chief steward for the Communication Workers of America Local 1103. The communication workers were on strike against telecom giant NYIAX Corporation, which became part of the present-day Verizon Company. At issue was management's proposal to shift a greater share of the healthcare costs onto the backs of workers. The strike wore on for a total of 17 weeks. In total, nearly 60,000 telephone workers in the Northeast participated in the walkout. These included both CWA members as well as members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Jerry Horgan was part of the strike in the town of Valhalla, New York, about 25 miles north of New York City. Jerry was struck by a vehicle driven by a strikebreaker while walking the picket line. The driver was the daughter of one of the company's managers. She was never charged for hitting Jerry, although some at the scene claimed she accelerated after hitting him with her car. One witness, Charles Pierce, recalled that Jerry was run down like a dog. The CWA honors Jerry's memory by wearing red t-shirts. In 2010, a CWA article titled "Why We Wear Red" explained, quote, "The idea started small. We asked our members to wear red on Thursday to remind the company of the blood they had spilled and to show support for our fallen brother. But it quickly spread nationwide as a sign of solidarity every Thursday at CWA locations. Jerry Horgan was killed standing up for the rights of workers and fighting
for a better tomorrow for all workers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
And now today's report from Climate Connections focuses on growing pollution, jellyfish numbers, and Rhode Island shores.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Every summer, visitors flock to the beaches along Rhode Island's 400 miles of coastline, and the locals gain the benefits of a $5 billion tourism industry. But climate change is starting to interfere with Rhode Island's beach season.
We have seen more and more heavy rain events.
Pam Rubinoff is a coastal resilience specialist for Rhode Island Sea Grant. She says excess rain washes lawn fertilizers and other pollutants into the ocean. It can also overwhelm sewer systems.
Sometimes that runoff will cause areas in the water to be cut off to swimming.
And even when beaches are open, beachgoers may encounter problems.
So we have our bay waters are getting warmer. We have our air temperature obviously getting warmer.
Warm days might seem like ideal beach weather, but warmer water can increase the number of jellyfish, harmful algal blooms, and seaweed.
So we're kind of seeing the full gamut, and all of that affects the tourism industry one way or another.
The problem cannot be easily avoided by picking a different beach for your vacation. All around the country, swimmers and sunbathers are facing similar challenges. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an in-depth interview with author Tommy Pico about his book, Nature Poem, at 5:45, followed by Cutie Pock Talk at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be sunny with a high of 82. East of the Cascades and Hood River will also be sunny and 85. Today in history, the Woodstock Arts and Music Festival opened in Bethel, New York in 1969. The quote of the day is from singer Richie Havens. Quote, "Woodstock was both a peaceful protest and a global celebration," end quote.
President Trump's statements about entertaining a military option in Venezuela were met with scrutiny on both sides of the proverbial fence. The statements followed U.S. sanctions against President Nicolas Maduro and were intended to send a strong message against Maduro's often lethal methods of quelling opposition protests. Yet Trump's statements may have an unintended consequence, helping Venezuela avoid default. Maduro is in desperate need of support, both international and local, and has frequently asserted that imperialist powers are scheming to topple him by coup or invasion. Both Trump's statements now firmly entrench in the minds of Venezuela's people. Some feel that this could bring a measure of solidarity on both sides of the protest, and thus support to Maduro's claims. "He's going to milk this," says Jan Den, head of the research at Ashmore Group PLC. In an interview with Bloomberg News, she states that it reinforces his own rhetoric that the reason Venezuela has a problem is an international economic war orchestrated in large part by the U.S. This reinforcement may have encouraged bondholders, including Ashmore Group, which is the third largest holder of Venezuelan sovereign debt. An additional capital would allow Maduro to prioritize debt payments over social programs to shore up his popularity ahead of regional elections.
The Kurdish people have long sought independence. They are currently one of the most populous ethnicities represented in the Middle East, yet they are still vying for permanency in their nation state. And now the Iraqi Kurds want a referendum. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson requested that the Kurdistan Regional Government delay a vote in September because U.S. officials feel it would detract from, quote, more urgent priorities, end quote, in the region, such as ISIS. U.S. officials are also worried that a move towards Kurdish independence could renew conflict in countries where Kurdistan currently resides. But now the Iraqi Kurds have decided to proceed with the referendum anyway. Given that over 98% of the Kurdish population already voted for independence in 2005, one could assume that this vote would have similar results. But much assumptions could also be made as to why the Kurdish people are ignoring U.S. officials' request for the delay.
And now let's hear from our pals at H2O Radio.
States challenge Native Americans' claims to groundwater. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
There is a water case so significant that last week, 10 states, from Nevada to Texas, asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review it.
A federal appeals court recently ruled that the Agua Caliente tribe has a right to groundwater dating back to the creation of their reservation in the 1870s.
That could mean that tribes have federally protected rights to surface and groundwater that would give Native Americans priority over rights created under state law.
The Desert Sun reports that the Agua Caliente tribe sued agencies in 2013, asserting that they had rights to groundwater under its reservation in Palm Springs, California, and the surrounding area.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, and if its ruling prevails, the case would set a powerful precedent for other tribes across the country, strengthening their claims to groundwater.
There's no guarantee that the High Court will take the case. However, it seems more likely because the U.S. Supreme Court has never been asked to rule on Native American claims to similar water rights.
While attention has been focused on the rhetoric between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, a dire humanitarian crisis is facing the people of Kim's country: drought and famine.
The United Nations warned late last month that the lack of rain could be the worst for the country since 2001. This year, a severe dry spell hampered the planting season for rice and cereal-producing provinces.
Famine due to drought is not new in North Korea. CNN reports from 1995 to 1999, about 2 to 3 million people died from hunger.
In 2016, the UN said that about 40% of the North Korean population was malnourished. Now the UN Food and Agriculture Organization is calling for other countries to donate more food. But the likelihood of that is not great, given the international community's inclination for increased sanctions.
Scott Pruitt, head of the EPA, is dismantling the agency by closing offices, eliminating staff, and rolling back regulations. And he's doing so as secretly as he can.
Interviews conducted by the New York Times of 20 current and former EPA employees reveal that Pruitt takes extraordinary steps to run the agency behind closed doors. Literally.
Some told the Times that doors to the floor with Pruitt's offices are locked, and employees must have an escort to gain entrance. Some are also told not to bring cell phones to meetings and not to take notes. Pruitt has armed security with him 24/7 and sometimes makes important calls not from his own office, but elsewhere.
An example of the stealth of Pruitt's method in rolling back rules is how the agency has reset the definition of the waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act. Staffers were told to eliminate an assessment by the Obama administration's proposed rule that showed favorable economic results.
A report was then prepared saying that there was no economic benefit to preserving wetlands, when the earlier version showed a benefit of nearly $600 million. The process to change the analysis was done overnight without the usual examination that can take up to months or even years.
Pruitt's secrecy has recently drawn a lot lawsuit. The state of California is suing the agency because it allegedly failed to comply with a request for documents that might indicate whether Pruitt has conflicts of interest.
The suit is aimed at stopping Pruitt from being involved in rolling back rules over which he sued EPA while Oklahoma's attorney general. An EPA spokesperson denied the allegations.
Wildfires across the U.S. have burned almost 6 million acres, which is nearly 2 million more than the average.
Smoke from the fires has spread east across the country. Conditions were so bad in Montana that the people of the town of Seeley Lake were advised to leave, or at least find somewhere else to sleep due to the smoke.
Fires have also been burning in Canada, Italy, Romania, Russia, and other parts of Europe, and even in Greenland, an island covered mostly in ice.
According to Wildfire Today, thousands of acres of permafrost are being charred, releasing carbon as they burn.
This news about wildfires comes as NOAA recently released data showing that the first half of this year was the second warmest ever for the planet, and that the month of June was the third hottest.
In Europe, a record-breaking heat wave has been dubbed Lucifer, and the New York Times reports that in parts of Asia, including Pakistan, new high temperature records have people comparing it to living in hell.
High temperatures also struck the American Northwest and Southwest. Think Progress reports that based upon 20 studies, extreme heat is one of the signature characteristics of global climate change.
In other words, the hotter the world is, the greater chance that a heat wave will bring extreme temperatures.
Finally, seems like climate change has a sense of humor. Last week, a floating art installation designed to raise awareness about rising waters sunk during a severe storm.
An environmental art project called Wetland, that looks like a partially submerged home, was inspired by images of houses flooded during Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy.
But last weekend, the artwork that's built on a houseboat collapsed after it took on water from heavy rain and was pummeled by debris floating down the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia.
Ironically, the artist Mary Mattingly had created the work as a commentary on climate change. According to WHYY, the installation included solutions like solar panels as well as a water garden that might help coastal residents adapt to environmental damage.
The Philadelphia Inquirer reports that the plan is to lift the boat from the river bottom and tow it to a location to assess the damage. That undertaking could cost thousands of dollars, and it's not clear who will ultimately foot the bill for removal, but it's fair to say it won't be cheap.
But neither is the adaptation to climate change, and perhaps that's the biggest takeaway from the artwork's message.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Discuss your water infrastructure challenges and solutions at WIC 17, October 30th through November 2nd. Find out more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Today we have the final episode of DI Squared, KBOO's feature on small businesses and how they are formed in the Portland area. This week, we'll take you to a coffee shop with a Native American flavor. Our guest, Loretta Guzman, talks about how her dream of a bison led her down the trail of an entrepreneur. We'll also revisit some of our earlier episodes for lessons learned. Here's DI Squared. Dream it, do it. Welcome to DI Squared, a 10-part weekly feature of KBOO News. DI Squared stands for Dream It, Do It. Today we present episode 10, the final episode in the series. We've been asking this question every week for over 2 months. Have you ever thought about starting your own business? Have you wondered, could I make a living doing something I really like doing? This is the last episode in a series that's designed to help you understand the basics of starting a business and whether you might want to think about that. Each week, we've told another local success story, and we've tried to give you some of the tools you need to start a business of your own. We've been focusing on minority businesses, mostly people of color. Last week, we visited the Mercado on Foster Road in southeast Portland. We met a man whose family came from Oaxaca in the mid-1980s. And now operates the Mixteca food cart at the Mercado and sells fresh food at 5 city markets. Today we meet a successful woman with Native American roots, Loretta Guzman. Loretta had a vision, and it came to her in a dream in the form of a bison. And now she operates a coffee shop on Cully in Northeast, where you can feel that spirit while enjoying a cup of coffee and a snack. Then, to wrap things up, we'll briefly revisit a few of our earlier episodes and sum up some lessons learned along the way from Portland's entrepreneurs and business advisors. Loretta had cancer. She went to her family's home with the Shoshone-Bannock tribe of the Fort Hill Indian Reservation in southern Idaho. Here she tells the story of the bison and her recovery.
I was sick. I was really, really sick. I could feel myself dying. And I ended up going through treatment, and while I was going through treatment, I ended up having a dream, and I was dreaming about this really big bison trying to get close to me. And I could just feel him trying to get closer and closer to me. And I told my mother about it, and she just looked at me, and then she told me, she said, tell Grandpa. So, and I told him about my dream, and he told me, he said, well, I'm glad you told me, that's your grandpa. And so I was just dreaming about that, and he said, that's your grandpa. He says, you'll get better. He said, I've been praying that your grandparents will help you. And I end up going into remission, and I end up getting better. And I was a stage 4B cancer. I was really far along at the time I found out, because I could literally, like, feel myself dying.
How did she decide on a coffee shop?
Well, I've been doing coffee for a long time. I have a lot of experience in it. I've been a manager for a long time, and I totally ran Kibby Reedman's cafe. So I talked with him, and he told me to do it. He says, do it. You will be successful. He goes, Bison Coffee House, that's your name. He said, there's no more discussing it. He said, this is your name. I said, okay. So at that point, I became the Bison Coffee House.
By the way, we're sitting in the Bison Coffee House. Right in front of us is the huge head of a bison on the wall. Where did that come from?
I bought him off of the internet. I had been searching and searching, not just any bison, but when I did find this one, I said, that is him. I got really excited. I said, that's him. I started jumping around.
This is a stupid question. Is there a difference between a bison and a buffalo?
A buffalo is from Africa. The bison is from here.
What about renovating this building? Where did the funds come from?
It cost me a lot. I worked on it for 2 years as I worked my regular job, and I just saved my money, and I did a lot of beadwork and selling my beadwork to other natives that would request, like, beaded capes, beaded moccasins, beaded leggings, hair ties, beaded bags, barrettes. I would bead these whole outfits for them, and they would pay me for them, and I would use the money towards my building here.
Loretta, there are some really interesting photographs here on the table. Are any of these photographs of members of your family?
The pictures under the glass on the coffee buffet, those are some of our family members. Some of them are my mother's father, the one I told you that I dreamt about, and pictures of my grandmother when she was little, and then pictures of my grandmother holding my mother when my mother was a baby in her cradle board.
How's the business working for you?
I think it's going pretty good for me. I get a lot of support from the Native community. Other Natives, while they're traveling, they stop through here. But also from the neighborhood here. The neighborhood has been really supportive to me, and they're just happy to have their own coffee house. I felt like I needed to represent our people in a positive way from the present and the past. Our people from the past are the reason why we are here today, and also the bison is something that is very meaningful to us as Natives, because, like, for our people, it was our livelihood.
Yeah.
And as they tried to be extinct, they also tried to extinct us as Natives also. But they're here and we're here.
You said you got some help from MISO. What's been your relationship with that group?
I met MISO just before I opened. I'm in their 3-to-1 match. I did receive money from my tribe. The tribes had sued the government for the mismanagement of our treaties. And so it's money that should have went to our ancestors. I used every dime of it for here because it was not my money to spend. For me, I used it to put into here to give them a voice.
What would you tell someone who asked you for advice on how to get started?
I would tell them, be prepared to work 7 days a week if you want to make it work. you're going to have to work hard, and you got to have the endurance. If you don't have the endurance, you're not going to make it.
The Cully neighborhood is gentrifying, changing. Here's what Loretta had to say about that.
Yes, we got a really good community here. It's sad when we see somebody who's lived in this neighborhood for a long time and they come and say, well, I have to move. Our rent is raising and I can't afford it. Or they're like, oh, they're selling our house that we're renting, so we have to move. And then we got other people moving from out of state here, and they come here and they're like, oh, I just bought a house over here. I just moved from another state, they always tell you. And
now Loretta's getting ready for Bison Coffee's anniversary.
I am right now in the process of saving and collecting new artwork so I can do a revamp come fall time when I get ready to do my anniversary. Because I did open on Veterans Day because veterans have been in the wars from the very beginning, and they are the majority who have always enlisted and enrolled our Native Americans, because they do fight for this land, because we are people of this land. And so on that day, I do honor them and allow them to come in here and get a free cup of coffee, a latte, tea, or if they want something to eat.
Like I said, that's the bison of the century over there.
That's
and if
right.
If somebody wanted to see that, just that would be a reason to come here, just to see that. But on top of that, there would be the chance to meet you.
Thank you.
That was Loretta Guzman. Now we go back and sample a few memorable DI Squared guests over the past 2 months. Bertone Faustin talked about how his business changed his life.
When I started, I didn't want to be the black winemaker. I just wanted to do my own thing. But now I am a trailblazer. My day in and day out inspires and empowers people to do anything in any industry.
Here's Christian Kofi, Portland Moving Company, talking about what guides him.
Trust your instincts, because most of the time we have to make decisions that can either make or break your business. So you have to trust your gut and also be very consistent. Consistency in what we do matters a lot, because we basically do most of the same thing every day. So.
Eric Ufer is a pest control fanatic. Keep your day job, Eric suggests.
Do what you're passionate about. Don't be concerned about what others say. So when you love something, it isn't work. Yes, you need the capital to go ahead and sustain yourself. Not only do you need to invest in your company, if you have your day job, keep it. Get your business running on the side. And once you feel that you're at the point where you can sustain yourself, I would say it's a lot easier to make that transition.
Sam Brooks of OAMI, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, is a legend in Oregon's business world. Here's Sam talking about his five crucial points of success.
You say that you need to know how to manage and grow your business. You need to be able to get access to capital. You need to understand why networking is important. You have to know how to use the technology. And you have to make sure that you're marketing or selling your product or service.
It was a treat to meet Julie Derrick, JD Shoe Repair. And here's a point she made.
I would just want them to deeply assess if their concept is viable. Do people want that? I mean, can you afford to do it until you really make money? Is it something that can actually work?
Nita Shah of Miso offered this advice for those who have poor credit.
If they have credit that needs enhancing, MISO will sit with them and give them really small loans to start getting their credit established once again. If you walk in the door and say, I want $50,000, that's not going to be possible. We're going to have to make sure that you have a business plan, that your strategies are pretty tight, but we will at that time help them get set up for future success in financing.
It's nice to hear about success. Michelle Sanders and her husband Miguel Salinas have come a long way.
We sell to 220 stores around the nation and have distributors in other countries. We sell online. We were featured in Oprah last October. We work pretty hard to be known out in the marketplace.
And Laura Locker of Northwest Mercy Corps told us about the IDA program.
We're really fortunate to be one of the 10 organizations in the state that give IDA grants, which is an individual development account. It's a matched savings program where you enter the program, you begin a savings account, you make regular monthly deposits, you reach a savings goal of $600, you finish educational requirements like taking a business class, writing a business plan, and in the end, you get a $3,000 grant to use towards whatever sort of business assets you might need.
Thanks for listening. If you want to review what you've just heard, go to kboo.fm and look under Evening News for today's date, or look in KBOO's podcast section for all 10 episodes. That's it for DI Squared. We've run our course, and it's been fun. Like everything else, it has to end sometime. We hope you've enjoyed hearing these stories and perhaps making a decision on whether you should dream it, do it. For KBOO News, I'm Tom Flynn. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you covered a local event and have audio or video that you want to share with the KBOO audience, we want to hear from you. Call us at 503-231-8032 or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Letigre, Zion Bro, Al Kahn, Fox Wild, and Dagan McSwain. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Special thanks to Native Voice One. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Kyle. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland talks about our planetary crisis with journalist Richard Heinberg and asks, are we doomed? At 9, on Political Perspectives, Walter Johnson describes a river of dark dreams, slavery and empire in the Cotton Kingdom. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Food Show talks to Dub Travis, owner of Dub St. John's, about Support Black-Owned Restaurants Week 2017, plus Laura Shapiro's book, What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women, and the Food That Tells Their Stories. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Zelos Marchant, and I have in the studio Tommy Pico.
Hello.
The amazing.
Hi.
What's up? Author of Nature Poem and IRL. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for coming down. So, Nature Poem changed my life, like some books can, and I've read it probably 5 or 6 times since I received it, and it vocalized a lot of things that I felt like I couldn't articulate. I really appreciated the the oxymorons and the sarcasm that slowly but surely grounded the definition of what is nature to a pulp by the end.
I am both an oxymoron and sarcastic. So I'm glad that that was transmitted through my writing. But also I feel like too that the premise of the book to be in defiance of nature poems, but actually to be a nature poem, like, mm-hmm. you know, I just kind of, I was like, that seemed like enough of an adhering principle to keep going and to like make one consistent long work about that.
It struck me as a, just because as a cutie pock myself, I've felt incredible pressure to be a nature poem for the world. And then also as a writer, as a creative, that, you know, I can't write about it. I remember having lots of attempts where I wanted to write about nature, and I felt like I absolutely couldn't. I felt angry about that. Mm. And talking to other creatives in the cutie pock sphere, feeling the same way, as in, like, you know, as we were mentioning earlier before we, like, before we started the interview, just because you discovered something doesn't mean that it's new. And, you know, and then the juxtaposition of that is, because it's not new doesn't mean that it's dead.
Mm. Well, you want to go deep? If you want to
dive deep, yeah. So, I mean, to, I guess, tie off of that, there's lots of themes in both IRL and nature poem with the core and with singing and music. Mm. I really wanted to ask, are you taking singing lessons right now?
I am. Not because I am a singer. I mean, everyone's a singer.
Right.
You know, and everybody wants to sing, especially people who say they can't sing. Like, everyone really does. Everybody, it's such, I mean, it's like a sing. Primordial art. It's with you wherever you go, you know? And, but I am currently taking singing lessons, again, not because I'm like a quote unquote singer, but because I'm working on something that requires, like, singing. Well, I can't talk about the details of it, but I'm working on something that incorporates singing into it, and so, you know, I feel like in order to write about it, I have to have this like somatic experience of it. So, you know, I'm like doing my breath exercises and stuff like that. but the thing is, like, what I tried to express, I guess, in Nature Poem, this is something that I only understood after the fact. Like, when I'm writing something, I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. But after the fact, I was looking at it, and I was like, you know, I think this main character, this Teebs character in it, you know, he is seeing that other people have a majestic idea of what nature is, mm-hmm. and that, like, there's a spiritual experience that people have with nature. And so he's trying to interpret that by expressing the kind of spiritual experiences that he has, and the one that he has is through singing, mm-hmm. you know, and through the appreciation of singers, and to be like, you know, blue breath breaking on a voice is the kind of magic mm-hmm. that makes people believe, you know, that, like, it is magic. Singing is magic. Mm-hmm. It's literal magic. And it floors me every single time.
I when reading RL especially, there's an excerpt and where Teebs, the character,
as you put it,
is talking about having voice lessons, talking about how the teacher just keeps asking him to find your breath mm-hmm. and let it flow, and then it has something to do with the core. And that was, from there, was a metaphor that for, like, what is that? And, core can mean something different to so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean when you're displaced? It seemed like, and anybody who's ever taken vocal lessons, anybody who's ever loved to sing, whether it's just at a karaoke place mm-hmm. or something competitive, can, I think, kind of relate to that. For me, as somebody of color, I was definitely like, exactly. In my head, taking singing lessons, I almost felt indignant. Like, mm-hmm. Why are you asking me to relate to this? Mm-hmm. Like, if we, our cores are built of the same thing, and what does it mean to be free in the first place?
Mm. Yeah. And also that blocked, essentially, like, there are so many things that keep you from your, like, quote-unquote natural voice, right?
Yeah.
Blocked emotions. There are certain things. What I love about singing lessons is they make you address the way in which you carry your body, because there is an optimal way to carry yourself to produce your purest vocal tone, right? So it's like, pretend that you have magnets at the bottom of your feet and at the top of your head, and you pull out your hands up. I'm like a crucifixion, and then you drop them because that's the position of the shoulders, and then, but that leaves your chest very open. And the thing is, like, one of the refrains in IRL is like having scooped shoulders. It's an attempt to protect the heart. You know what I mean? You're trying to protect your chest, and so pushing your shoulders back is a sign of vulnerability, but also confidence, right? And when you start to think about this, when the innate process of breathing becomes something conscious, you have to start thinking about, well, what bowed you in the first place? Why are you trying to disappear? You know, like, why do you carry yourself as if you don't deserve to be in this world? And so singing lessons for me always just helped me open up and be like, I'm here. You know?
Absolutely. That leads into my next question of going back to Nature Poem, where the defining of nature, the way you said, well, we can't talk about nature unless we talk about, well, pretty much like colonialism and capitalism and all of that, which really I read to mean also normalization. We can't talk about nature unless we talk about what's normal.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't talk about what's normal without talking about the conflict of residing inside of something.
Mm-hmm.
So were those themes intentional?
It's funny that you picked up on that, because initially, I wrote Nature Poem in Portland, shout out, as a zine, after I had just finished, in the summer of 2014, I spent 4 months writing IRL, like, incessantly every single day. It's a very obsessive poem. I don't know if you could pick that up.
I think we could.
But also, it's very vigorous and unending, you know. After I finished that, I was like, I cannot write like that anymore. You know, it required a kind of excess that, like, I couldn't keep putting my body through. So I was like, I have to figure out a different way of writing. And it was the first time I'd written, it was the first time I'd written anything that long. It was the first time I'd written a book, and I had sat down and I'd done it. And after I was over, I was like, that whirlwind cannot continue. So I came out here to Portland. I stayed with my friend Roy, who lives in North Portland. Shout out, Roy. I love you. And I was like, my intention was to do absolutely nothing. I was like, I'm going to sit on this porch. I'm going to drink this vino verde. And I'm going to pet some kitties. And that's it. And that was great. The first day went by, and I was just like, my feet were up. The sun was in my face. And, you know, everyone had that sort of, it's something that I think of being particularly stringent in the Pacific Northwest, which is like, everyone is so happy the sun is out, you know? Whereas, like, people in New York resent the sun because for half of the year, it only gives light. It never gives any heat. You know what I mean? And like, in people in Southern California, where I'm from, it's just all there. It's there all the time. There's no reason to appreciate it. It's not going anywhere. So I was, like, out there worshiping the sun on a porch, petting kitties, drinking a vino verde for 2 days. And then at the end of the second day, I was, because I'm really, really bad at relaxing, I was like, I'm doing nothing. And then I just, like, started writing Nature Poem. Because I had this argument with somebody right before I left. Argument's a strong word. It's not like I gave him that much time. But it was just, like, this white dude who was like, I was like, so my best friend was talking about how she can't eat watermelon and fried chicken in front of white people, right? And I was like, yeah, I was like, well, you know, I feel like with poetry, like, I can't write a nature poem because, like, that's what everyone expects an American Indian person to do. I'm not doing that at all. And there's this white guy at the bar, this person in the peanut gallery. First of all, why do they always think they can talk to us? Second of all, this person in the peanut gallery was like, wait a minute, why are you saying you can't write about nature? You can do whatever you want to. Why are you limiting yourself? And I was like, first of all, if you mind your own damn business. But second of all, like, you're assuming that my reticence to write about this, to write about nature, comes from a sense of me being blocked off from myself. Fuck you, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not limiting myself. I'm saying I'm not here to entertain you.
Mm-hmm.
But then I left. I didn't release him because he wasn't paying. I had a nature poem because you're dumb. And I don't remember where this particular conversation started, but that sort of became the impetus to write the book.
I paperclipped that page because that was like every time I go out, and which just went back to the whole conflicts of body residing in something, the idea that nature is perfect, the idea that we're born, like, as these weird, sacred, fetishized things that can't change and shouldn't change, you know, and yet...
that's a colonial invention.
That's a colonial invention, you know, and then to go out in the world and have people, you know, who have won the so-called winning side, which you address a lot in Nature Poem, you know, talking at Native American people, marginalized people, like, why can't you do the things? Why, you know, even though they miss the point that they're telling, they're telling you and preaching to you how you should be.
Still white women, and nobody brought you over. Nobody looked you up in the phone book and said, give me a call. Like, oh, I remember what you were talking about before, and it was the, like, nature and normal. Okay, so I had finished the zine version of Nature Poem. I wrote it in 2 weeks. It was like 23 pages. I sent it to all my friends, and people were kind of excited about it. And then I read from it, and people were like, oh, what is this? Like, I got a reaction to it that I've never gotten from anything I've ever written up to that time. And I was like, is this good? And everyone's like, yeah, I think this is good. And I was like, oh. And people were encouraging me to turn it into a book. And at that time, NYU got in contact with me and commissioned me to write, to make a performance in response to a eugenics exhibit that they had done. And so I did it because they paid me for it, and I turned it into, it was called Normal Poem. And so I thought this was going to be a triptych called Normal Poem, or Nature Poem, Normal Poem, and Perfect Poem. But they all ended up getting folded into Nature Poem. Yeah.
Oh, but that answered, I mean, one of the top things I was dying to know was, did you write this in triplicate? Did you write it in triple? Because the first, you know, I definitely felt the whole book in three-part sections like that, where there was this, and I was, there was just this, like, approach of, like, okay, what is normal, you know, what is natural, what is perfect. So that's really cool to hear the backstory about that.
It sounds like you really read it.
I loved it. And I mean, I think it's just, I mean, just to have something that articulated that in such a real way, like, you know, you're going to a bar and you're getting just over by peanut galleries who are telling you, like, or ask, who are, have they, you know, you're right, nobody dials them up, no one's asked them, but they feel like entitled that they can talk to anybody marginalized and supply what is normal for any of us in the first place.
They're like, you know? Let me come tell you what you are.
Let me, yeah, let me come to, and with a side note, I especially loved the excerpts about dating. relationships with somebody like that in Nature Poem, which I felt like, isn't that just like the jungle, though?
It really is.
The mating habits of the